From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
North Korea. Are America's provocations making things better or worse? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point. As North Korea continues its nuclear program, the Trump administration says America has lost its strategic patience. What does that mean? A U.S. carrier and a nuclear submarine are conducting drills in the Western Pacific. China is urging President Trump to exercise restraint. The entire U.S. Senate was bussed from Capitol Hill to the White House. Was that political theater, or did they learn anything new? We'll hear about possible options from diplomacy to economic sanctions to preventative war. Later on today's Talking Point, another giant step for humankind in the solar system. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more. 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
I'm Warren Alney, back with To the Point. For 25 years, the U.S. has viewed North Korea's nuclear program with increasing alarm. Now, President Trump says this country has lost its strategic patience. We'll hear what he's actually doing and what might come next. Today's Talking Point, after circling the planet Saturn for 13 years, the spacecraft Cassini has run out of fuel, but it's still sending new science back to Earth, more than 750 million miles away. After a round of cheers over its latest achievement, one team member with proud understatement called it a very good spacecraft. We'll hear more. First, this news update. During his campaign, Donald Trump called NAFTA one of the worst trade deals ever made. Yesterday, his staff said he was ready to pull America out. But last night, he talked with Canada's prime minister and Mexico's president, and here's what he said today.
So they asked me to renegotiate. I will, and I think we'll be successful in the renegotiation, which frankly would be good because it would be simpler. But we have to make a deal that's fair for the United States. They understand that.
Sean Donnan is world trade editor for the Financial Times. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
The president said that terminating NAFTA would be a pretty big shock to the system. Did he just learn that last night?
I don't think he just learned that last night. I think what the administration is hiding a little bit here is actually what was a pretty fierce debate in recent days over what to do with NAFTA. You have one wing of the White House, the kind of economic nationalist, if you will, saying let's get tough, let's pull out of this thing, let's move on, and then you have another a kind of more business friendly wing, the kind of Gary Cohn's, who's the head of the National Economic Council, saying hang on a second here, we got to live up to some or recognize some economic realities. The reality is there's $1 trillion in trade that happens between the U.S. and Canada and Mexico every year, and that is huge. Mexico and Canada are the second and third largest trading partners for the U.S. In fact, do twice as much trade. The U.S. does twice as much trade with Canada and Mexico as it does with China, which is pretty impressive when you think that my daughter this morning was saying to me, everything's made in China that you get in the shops. So it's a huge economic relationship, and North America has become this kind of integrated manufacturing center. Our cars aren't just made in the U.S. anymore, and that angers some people, but they're made in, you know, with parts from Mexico and Canada and pulled together sometimes in the U.S., sometimes in Mexico, other times in Canada. And that actually, you know, there's been big consumer benefits for that as well as benefits for companies.
Good to have a daughter who understands finance. Didn't the Obama team renegotiate provisions of NAFTA while they were negotiating the Trans-Pacific Partnership? And didn't those just sort of go out of business when the TPP went down?
Absolutely. Look, that's something we need to remember. You know, Donald Trump is not the first American president to promise a renegotiation of NAFTA. That's something that Barack Obama ran on in 2008 when he was elected. He chose to live up to that by negotiating this Trans-Pacific Partnership, which pulled in Japan as well as the NAFTA countries, and there were a half dozen or more other countries in the Asia-Pacific, and it became this much bigger project. Now, Donald Trump clearly ran against NAFTA, calling it a disaster, and against the TPP. And, the one big, and actually the biggest trade action he's taken so far was on day one or his first working day in the presidency, and that was to pull the U.S. out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Well, tell me this. What exactly does the United States want to change about NAFTA?
So the funny thing is that actually what Donald Trump seems to want a lot of is a lot of what was happening with TPP that Barack Obama negotiated. And that's kind of updating the labor and environmental chapters, arguing that you need to have fairer environmental rules to make sure that Mexico can't leverage weaker environmental laws to take advantage and draw jobs down there. But you also there's a big focus on something called the rules of origin. And that's a really dull term for something really important, and that is how much of a product is actually made within a trade zone, if you will. And the argument for the Trump administration is that right now that amount that is required to be made inside NAFTA countries to benefit from that isn't high enough. And particularly with cars, they want to increase that, raise that higher, and they believe that would bring more manufacturing jobs back to the U.S.
So once again, given the conversation between the three heads of state, do you think it really will be easier now to negotiate NAFTA than it's been before?
I don't know. I mean, we've gotten a taste of the potential acrimony that we're going to get in the last few days. When you think about what Donald Trump has railed against Canada over dairy and its restrictions on dairy imports from the U.S., the tariffs that they imposed earlier this week on lumber imports from Canada. There's also a negotiation going on with Mexico on sugar. Trade gets pretty hairy. And pretty forthright in the negotiating room. And there's a lot of, there are things that Canada and Mexico are going to want as well. This is going to be a pretty complicated negotiation. There's one other big factor that kind of looms over this, and that is that Mexico has really important elections in the middle of next year, and one of the big debates there is a left-wing populist who would actually blow NAFTA up if he could as well.
Sean Donnan with the Financial Times, many thanks.
Thanks for having me.
In a moment, North Korea. Are America's provocations making things better or worse? This is To the Point from PRI.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Well, we're not only back with To the Point. With President Trump nearing his 100th day in office, yesterday saw another unprecedented Washington moment. The entire United States Senate was bussed from Capitol Hill to the White House to get a briefing from administration officials on North Korea. Here's a sampling of senatorial reactions.
It was an okay briefing.
What do you mean it's an okay briefing? You didn't really learn much?
It was okay.
This is a very consequential meeting, I thought, today at the White House, just to talk about what is happening with North Korea's increased capacity and the point that the days of strategic patience have to be over.
I seriously felt like I could have gotten all that information by reading a newspaper. I did not see any new information coming out of that briefing at all. It felt more like a dog and pony show to me than anything else.
Those were two Republicans, Bob Corker of Tennessee and John Barrasso of Wyoming, and Democrat Tammy Duckworth of Illinois. Michael Crowley, a senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Thanks for joining us, as always.
Thanks for having me.
So it's pretty unusual. I don't know if it's ever happened before for the entire Senate to be bussed down to the White House. You would think that it would have been pretty important, but it sounded like, at least from two people, one Republican, one Democrat, that it wasn't worth the trip.
Yeah, I can't say definitively that it was unprecedented, but I can't remember anything like it, nor have I seen anyone else point out a precedent. But this is life in the era of Trump. Trump's governance and his foreign policy in particular has very much been about theatrics, and this, I think, was a largely theatrical stunt, you might call it. This briefing could have been done at the Capitol, briefings like it often are, but Trump is trying to elevate the importance of North Korea as a U.S. foreign policy priority. He's doing it in a lot of theatrical ways we can talk more about, but I think this was one of them.
Okay. Other things which may or may not be theatrical are the presence of the American Navy in the Western Pacific.
Yeah, Warren, but even that, you know, the main actor there is a U.S. aircraft carrier that is headed in the now, after going in a different direction and some confusion about its actual mission and what the military was saying, is now headed in the direction of North Korea. But, you know, we are actually not very likely to attack North Korea with an aircraft carrier. We would be doing it with long-range strategic bombers and standoff, you know, kind of Tomahawk-style missiles. And that is if we were to attack North Korea, which, Warren, I think is extremely unlikely in the near term. The consequences, the risk involved in hitting North Korea is tremendous. The potential consequences are horrific, and it's the kind of option that, you know, sane people would generally reserve for the very last desperate minute when they think either that the North Koreans are going to mount a major attack themselves, or maybe, and this is a longer conversation, they are on the brink of developing a missile that could bring a nuclear warhead to United States shores. But in the coming days, weeks, even few months, I think there's virtually no chance Trump is going to strike North Korea militarily.
So the Vinson is headed in the right direction, finally. What about the, isn't there a nuclear submarine also in that vicinity?
Yeah, look, you know, we have all kinds of military assets that we're trying to show off. There was also a test a couple days ago of, I believe it was a U.S. Minuteman missile that is another possible way we could strike North Korea. You know, I've been talking to lots of experts and people who have worked on North Korea policy at the Pentagon and the NSC in the last few days for a story I'm writing. You know, people see this as largely psychological. I mean, number one, it's demonstrating to the North Korean regime that if they were to lash out, we can hit them back hard and quickly and decisively defeat them. Number two, reassuring allies in the region that we have their backs, so to speak, Japan and South Korea in particular, but also psychologically messaging to North Korea and also the Chinese kind of a new level of seriousness. I mean, these may be theatrics, and I think that people in North Korea and China aren't really expecting an attack, but psychologically, it's just human nature. It's going to make you stand up and pay attention and reconsider what is the U.S. capable of doing here, and what should we be doing to cover ourselves and hedge our bets and lower the risks to us.
Okay. And of course, we have the North Koreans ratcheting up the rhetoric and talking about nuclear war. Philip Yun is with us. He's executive director of the Plowshares Fund, former senior advisor on North Korea during the Clinton administration. Good to have you on our program.
Good morning.
Are you concerned that even though this may be all psychologically intended, it could have or could lead to some sort of miscalculation on North Korea's part?
Absolutely, and that's what I've been talking about. I think that it's you know, absolutely right. I think it's very unlikely that North Korea is going to preemptively attack South Korea or the United States, or that the United States is going to preemptively attack North Korea. What I'm most worried about is miscalculation. I mean, what you have right now are military exercises going on with the United States and South Korea. So all told, you've got something like perhaps, you know, 1.5 million troops and military assets that go with that running around the peninsula, about a million man army in North Korea, about 500,000 South Korean troops, and depending if you bring in the Japanese, U.S. troops in Japan. something like 30,000 from U.S. troops in South Korea and about 50,000 in Japan. So that's a lot of things going on right now. And so what happens if you have a firefight across the DMZ? You have a clash of naval vessels someplace in the east of the peninsula or west of the peninsula, or a missile test or demonstration that goes off course, all three of which have happened in the past, and something or someone gets hit by accident. And then you top it off by having Kim Jong-un, who's relatively inexperienced. He's known for being very aggressive and for unpredictability, and you have Donald Trump in his new style as well. It's a bad mix, and what we have here, as if you've heard, is the steady drumbeat. And then, you know, one great way of saying a classic miscalculation. I mean, we thought, and we were talking about this, that the Carl Vinson Kerry Group was going to go to was going to Korea, and in fact, we found out that was not the case. And we didn't really know that, and there was all these rumors about a preemptive attack that was being planned that was reported by NBC but was subsequently denied. So all this stuff sort of cascades into creating a lot of pressure where people feel like they have to respond. And so that's what I'm worried about. It's tail end risk. Very unlikely. Consequences are huge, but things could line up in the wrong way, and then we've got a really terrible result.
Let me go back to Michael Crowley with Politico. Pretty embarrassing when the commander in the Pacific has to say, oh, wait, I made a mistake and indicated that the Vinson was going in one direction when, in fact, it was going in a different direction. Do we know that something more than that actually happened, and that and what does it say about the ability of the United States to have communications between the civilian and military authorities?
Warren, I think that we still don't know exactly how this went down. There have been some varying and conflicting statements. There was testimony from the U.S. Pacific Commander in the House yesterday where he accepted full responsibility, said that it was his fault and that he didn't communicate clearly to the press that this aircraft carrier was actually headed south for a secret exercise before it was subsequently going to head north. But, you know, I think it's healthy to have more skepticism than we might normally have because we have an administration that is understaffed and clearly has not been able to coordinate its message on all kinds of issues. And even just in this area we're talking about on policy toward China and North Korea, you're seeing a lot of conflicting statements, and they're having to clean up things that they've said. I would point as another example to the aftermath of the missile strikes in Syria, where you had a variety of explanations coming out of different administration officials about what kind of policy that represented. So I think I'm more skeptical than I would normally be this was just one guy's harmless error, as opposed to bad communication throughout the chain of command, including going up to the White House, where White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer echoed this claim that this ship was, indeed, I think was it Trump himself who described an armada headed toward North Korea. Why does this matter? Because it's really important that you have clear messaging both to your friends and enemies about what you're doing. And if your credibility diminishes, that causes you big problems with both your enemies and your friends. And, you know, we've already seen the South Koreans bitterly complaining about this episode and saying that they were very disappointed in the U.S. So the Trump administration is still figuring out a lot of things, including its fundamental policies. But one thing that's really important to do is to communicate clearly and consistently. And again, while we don't know exactly what happened and whether the fault entirely rested with this one commander, it's clear that across the board they have big messaging problems to solve.
So, Philip Yun, back to you with Plowshares. So you've indicated all the reasons you think that there could be yet another miscalculation with potentially catastrophic impact. I think you at the Plowshares Fund want to see the last of nuclear missiles and nuclear weapons. What about North Korea's development? And should we, in fact, have lost our strategic patience? And is it time to do something?
Well, North Korea at this point right now, we estimate they have something like between 15 to 25 nuclear weapons worth of material. And We believe various estimates they're making one nuclear weapons worth of material every 8 weeks. New York Times reported every 6 to 7 weeks. So if you do the rough calculations, they're about going to be close to having 50 nuclear weapons by 2020. That's a huge amount. And that's, you know, something like back in 2000 they had one or two. We know they've done five nuclear tests. That's a significant amount. They did five of those in 10 years. So, you know, it seems to me that they are on the verge, and they are strategically trying to basically get a nuclear device that's small enough to mount on a missile that probably at some point will hit the United States, be able to hit the continental United States. That's what they're aiming for, and that's what the concern is, and understandably so. So these are the things that we have to worry about. At the same time, we have to understand that, one, as was said earlier, the North Koreans are not irrational. They're not crazy. They're not suicidal. And I think we have to remember that deterrence, the whole notion of deterrence, does work and is working. And so, therefore, that gives us a little time to figure out how to deal with this issue and not to create unnecessary confrontations unless until it is absolutely necessary.
Deterrence essentially meaning that you strike us and we'll strike you only 50 times harder. Let me introduce Bruce Klingner. He is a former deputy division chief with the CIA for Korea, and he's now a research fellow for Northeast Asia at the Heritage Foundation. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Well, thanks for having me.
What do you think we ought to do?
Well, I think we need to have a comprehensive integrated strategy where we need to have a strong emphasis on enforcing U.S. laws, targeted financial measures, smart sanctions, along with keeping open the door for diplomacy, although unfortunately North Korea is the one that has repeatedly closed that door. They closed the New York channel, the last official communication link between the two governments last July. Negotiations, it'd be premature to go back to the six-party talks as long as North Korea says they will never, ever, ever abide by the prime objective. But you hope having greater pressure, greater enforcement of our laws, not only against North Korea, but other violators such as China using secondary sanctions. You know, you hope that works, but in the meantime, it is fulfilling objectives such as enforcing our laws, imposing penalties on those that break it, and it puts into place measures that make it more difficult for North Korea to import and export items for the prohibited programs. But then you do have to make sure you have sufficient defenses for yourself and your allies, and that's missile defense and re-strengthening the military after some of the degradations and capabilities during the past several years of budget cuts.
Secondary sanctions, explain that term.
Well, what that is doing is it's imposing sanctions or measures against entities other than North Korea that are in violation of either the UN resolutions or the U.S. laws. So, for example, you know, Chinese entities that are either banks or businesses or front companies that are facilitating the prohibited North Korean behavior.
And that we have the capacity to do that?
Oh, we've long had the authority to do that because it's based on, when people hear sanctions, they tend to think of trade sanctions, and because the U.S. Doesn't trade with North Korea, they think there's no impact there. Actually, what it's based on is that money has to cross borders, the most reclusive regime or terrorist group, and the vast majority of all international financial transactions in the world are denominated in dollars, which means they have to go through a U.S. Treasury Department-regulated bank in the United States. So if you send money from Paris to London, it's going through New York. And we know from the UN Committee of Experts, the majority of North Korean transactions are still denominated in dollars. And then not only they, but Chinese facilitators, you know, they are using dollar-denominated transactions. So they are using the U.S. financial system for illicit means.
Okay. We're going to take a very brief break. We'll come back and continue this conversation about what's happening with regard to the U.S. And North Korea and the other players as well, South Korea, China, Japan. In our talking point a little bit later at the end of our program, another giant step for humankind in the solar system has to do with the planet Saturn and its rings. This is To the Point from Public Radio International. Warren Olney back with To the Point. Once again, the Trump administration says the United States has now lost its strategic patience after so many years of the buildup of a nuclear program by North Korea. The question is what to do. Philip Young of the Plowshares Fund is concerned that if we do too much, we could miscalculate and lead to a catastrophic situation. Bruce Klingner thinks that catastrophe is always possible, but we're not doing enough. Bruce Klingner, what about the friendship bridge across the Yalu River between China and North Korea? I understand 70% of the traffic between those countries crosses that bridge on trucks. Could we do something about that?
Well, actually, China should be doing something about it. All countries, all UN member nations are required to inspect cargo going to and from North Korea, including that which transits their own country. So they're required to, you know, air and ship and land-based cargo, even including personal luggage and checked baggage, you know, according to the last two resolutions. So China should be inspecting all of that material that's going in and out of North Korea to ensure it's not, you know, violating UN resolutions.
Well, is that where nuclear material is coming from? Do we think it's crossing the bridge?
Well, I mean, the North Korean nuclear program is largely indigenous. They have, uranium resources themselves. You know, we know that components for the missiles, come from the outside world, you know, oftentimes through Chinese brokers. So, you know, whether it's air or sea or land-based, China and other nations are supposed to be inspecting the cargo, but we know that China, as is often the case, is not fully fulfilling the required sanctions or measures.
So that's not a likely possibility for us, then. That would be up to the Chinese. What should we do, do you think, to push the Chinese further?
Well,
secondary sanctions you were talking about earlier?
Yeah, that's a major thing. We know China has long been part of the problem rather than part of the solution. They essentially act like North Korea's lawyer in the UN Security Council. They've turned a blind eye to proliferation occurring on Chinese soil, and they've not cracked down on Chinese banks and businesses that are engaged with North Korea. So, you know, the secondary sanctions, as I was saying, is, you know, it's to target those entities that are in violation of U.S. law. They are misusing the U.S. financial system. So, you know, when people say, well, China won't go along with additional sanctions, we can influence the behavior of the Chinese banks and businesses, as we did in the past when, for example, the Bank of China defied the government of China and cut off its engagement with North Korea in the mid-2000s, and then the U.S. backed away from the pressure we are putting on North Korea. So you can pick off the entities that are in violation of U.S. law, and then the other ones will see that they do need to increase their own due diligence. And if they can't sufficiently vet the North Korean customers, then, you know, they'll need to look elsewhere for business.
All right. That option obviously has existed for a long time. The Obama administration chose not to pursue it. The Trump administration might or might not. Peter Beinart is with us. He's contributing editor at The Atlantic, associate professor of journalism, political science at the City University of New York, a familiar voice on our program. Peter Beinart, good to have you back.
Thank you.
Clearly, the Obama administration didn't do the sorts of things that we're hearing about now. Is, though, fundamentally, the administration of under Donald Trump pretty much doing the same thing, or is it really upping the ante?
Well, I think it's trying, as Mike Crowley was saying, it's trying to create psychological pressure by, you know, with the strike in Korea, I mean, in Syria, the strike in Afghanistan, all this tough talk, the military assets around, to try to scare the North Koreans and the Chinese, and make them think that the U.S. maybe might be willing to take military action. But I think the problem is that, as Mike Crowley said, the U.S. is very unlikely to take military action because military action would probably have horrific results. And what's missing from the conversation, I think, is an understanding of why China props up North Korea. It's not just because the Chinese are a bad actor, right? The Chinese, from their perspective, have reason to be concerned about the fall of the North Korean regime. They have, you know, the United States has this habit violently pursuing regime change halfway across the world, but it's the regimes next door. Ask the Jordanians what happened to them after we overthrew Saddam Hussein. The Chinese are concerned about North Korea becoming a failed state and people streaming across their borders. And they're also very concerned about a reunification of the Korean Peninsula that leaves U.S. troops on China's border. The last time that happened was 1950, and China went to war to prevent that from happening. So if you want, it seems to me, to have influence on the Chinese, you have to not only think about trying to ratchet up the pressure on them, you have to think about what America might be able to do to allay their concerns about what might follow if they put overwhelming pressure on North Korea.
How do we allay their concerns?
Well, I think one thing is that we could say that the United States would not deploy troops north of the demilitarized zone in what's now North Korea. Now, the Chinese might not believe us because the Soviets believed that the U.S. promised not to deploy troops in East Germany after the reunification of Germany, and we brought our troops all the way onto former Soviet soil in the Baltics. But you could have a conversation about trying to imagine what a reunified Korea would look like that would not be as threatening to China. You could support better relationships between China and South Korea. You could even talk about a future in which the U.S. withdrew its missile defense system in South Korea. It seems to me that if you want China to be more willing to take actions that could bring about the end of this regime, which would be a great blessing for the freedom of humanity, given that it's the closest thing we have to hell on earth, you have to think about trying to allay the security concerns that China has about what that would look like.
Let me go back to Bruce Klingner. Once again, you were deputy division chief with the CIA for Korea. You're now at the Heritage Foundation. But based on your previous experience, what about that? And is that a way of getting a diplomatic solution of some kind to make concessions on the part of the United States?
Well, I remember the Bush administration and the Obama administration repeatedly tried to have discussions with Chinese counterparts about sort of crisis situations or crisis scenarios with North Korea, as well as sort of post-unification conditions. And Beijing was the one who always refused to talk about it, either because they were concerned that talking about collapse scenarios would get back to Pyongyang, and thus, you know, would anger their ally and sort of reduce their Chinese influence or whatever. But, you know, the problem has been trying to get China to sit down, even, you know, sort of covertly to talk about the situations. You know, I don't think the U.S. has ever said we intend to put forces north of the DMZ after unification. I don't think we've had a declaration, but I don't think, you know, there would ever be in the intention to do so. In fact, I think after unification, there would be a push in both the U.S. and South Korea to reduce the forces there. You know, they would see it as the war is finally won. Let's bring the boys home incorrectly think that we'd be saving money that way. But, you know, we've been trying to talk with China, but they've often refused to do so.
The Korean War, of course, the fighting stopped in 1953, but there's never been a peace treaty between North and South Korea and the United States and North Korea. So, Peter Beinart, back to you. What about that? Do you think now, with the relationship between President Trump and President Xi of China, there's a better opportunity than there has been in the past when talks have not succeeded because China didn't want to do it?
I don't know. Look, I think one has to be pessimistic about the possibility of solving this, that the North Koreans have, from their perspective, very good reason to have nuclear weapons because they've seen what happens to America's adversaries when they don't have nuclear weapons. The North Koreans talk a lot about the example of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya, who gave up his nuclear weapons as part of a rapprochement with the West and ended up deposed with NATO assistance. So I think overall one generally has to recognize that the chances of any kind of massive shift that's going to lead to North Korea giving up its nuclear program or lead to the end of North Korea is slim. But I do think that if the Trump administration is succeeding in making the Chinese more afraid, and maybe they are, maybe they're not, I'm not sure, and that gives them some greater degree of leverage or makes the Chinese be willing to think in ways that they were not willing to think before, it seems the only way to translate that into action is also by reassuring the Chinese that the United States, that Chinese pressure could not lead to some of that the U.S. could help China deal with some of the worries that China has about what its own pressure on North Korea could produce.
Philip Yun, back to you with the Plowshares Fund.
Yeah.
What are the prospects that we're simply going to have to live with another nuclear power, one that is relatively smaller than Pakistan or India, for example, not to mention the United States and Russia, and which is probably not likely to use its capacity to attack us, even if it has it?
Well, I think if we continue with the current policy, so I think the Trump administration policy is trying to distinguish itself, but it's essentially using the same formula that was used in the early 2000s by George Bush, and it's essentially more pressure, more sanctions, and farming it out to China. The problem right now is that we have basically China playing good cop on one side, the United States, South Korea, and Japan playing bad cop, and good cop and bad cop do work. But they're not completely they're not coordinated at all, and so North Korea is driving a truck through this. Essentially, referring to what Peter is talking about, China wants the United States to be willing to use sweeter carrots, and then we, on the other hand, want China to use much harsher sticks. So if we can get some kind of agreement on that, there's a possibility of pursuing, and again, I agree with Peter and Bruce for the most part, that you know the prospect of North Korea giving up these weapons over the short term is not going to happen. But I do think that over time, there are possibilities there. I perhaps am more optimistic, and I think it's worth pursuing. It's a long shot, but I do think that we should try to do it, and then if it doesn't work, then you know the alternative becomes North Korea becoming, having a small nuclear arsenal with a delivery system, or we then have to choose to say if we can't accept it, we've got to, you know, risk a catastrophic war. That's where we see ourselves maybe 10 years from now. So I think it's worthwhile right now to see if we have, you know, we can. It's a narrow window if we can drive through that and make some get at least a freeze. For the time being and work towards that. I think it's worth pursuing, given what the consequences are.
Let me go back to Michael Crowley, our first guest, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Much has been said about the lack of staffing at the State Department, and this obviously is a very complicated and a very dangerous situation that we're talking about. How's the Trump administration doing in terms of appointing people who are knowledgeable, capable, and can handle this in the way that all of our guests, I think, would like to see it?
Well, it's very slow going, Warren, and there's not much sign that that's going to change, particularly at the State Department. You know, the attitude of the State Department seems to be there's really no rush. There are plans to do a lot of consolidation and reorganization and also cuts at the State Department. The budget is going to be cut in the president's proposal by 30%. Congress will probably make it a significantly smaller cut. But in general, the attitude at the State Department is to streamline and that there are a lot of people there who don't contribute much, and there's not a big rush to fill some of those jobs. Now, you know, kind of an interesting counterintuitive point I've seen people making is that some of these unfilled jobs, including the top official for Asian affairs and likewise, you know, the top State Department person for Russia, a lot of these really critical positions are being run by career diplomats who are not political appointees and who stay on across administrations. And some people are saying, would you rather have Donald Trump's political pick come in? Who knows who that's going to be? Who knows if it's somebody with any experience or good judgment? That's a view you hear from people who are sort of diplomatically minded, you know, mainstream foreign policy establishment types. And maybe you're better off having these career people who are professionals holding down the job. But it is an unusual state of affairs, and you see foreign governments complaining about it. I think they would like to, in some cases, they would like to see the political picks because they feel like those people have more juice at high levels of the administration. And one specific note I'll close on is that when Rex Tillerson went to Moscow a couple of weeks ago, he was needled by his counterpart, Russian Foreign Minister Sergey Lavrov, for not having a fully staffed department. And the Russians didn't have anyone they could be talking to at lower levels. So, yeah, that creates a problem, particularly if there's a crisis. I think there's confusion about who to call and who really would know what's going on. But again, doesn't seem to be much of a rush to start filling out these jobs.
Peter Beinart, Republicans like to cite Ronald Reagan for various things, sometimes accurately, sometimes not. Is there anything that Donald Trump could learn about President Reagan's reduction of nuclear weapons in his agreement with Mikhail Gorbachev?
Yeah, I mean, look, there are obviously all kinds of enormous differences, but it is worth remembering, and it's something I think Republicans generally don't remember, that one of Reagan's most important, I think perhaps his most important contribution to Mikhail Gorbachev's decision to allow Eastern Europe to break free was his reassurance of Gorbachev after Gorbachev took power in 1985. Actually, it's Reagan's move towards a dovish policy began even before Gorbachev took place in 84. It was because America signed the INF deal with the Soviets in 1987, and because America radically ratcheted that, changed the tenor of its relationship with the Soviet Union, became much, much warmer in the years when after Gorbachev took power, even though conservatives bitterly criticized Reagan for that. That helped Gorbachev convince his own hardliners that the Soviet Union should give up its Eastern European buffer and not be threatened by the United States. And I think it's worth remembering that when we think about China. If you want China to think about a world without North Korea, its longtime ally that it fought a war with in the Korean War, when it's surrounded by a lot of countries that are America's allies, you have to think about what America could do to make itself less threatening, to make China more willing to contemplate that world in which it would lose its North Korean buffer.
Okay. A lot of different ways of thinking about this very complex situation, which is going to be with us for some time to come. Thank you all, and we'll welcome you back to future programs. Peter Beinart with The Atlantic, also at the University of New York. Bruce Klingner, formerly with the CIA, Korea expert there, now with the Heritage Foundation. Philip Yun at the Plowshares Fund, a former senior advisor on North Korea during the Clinton administration. And Michael Crowley at Politico, senior foreign affairs correspondent. Great to have you all. Many thanks. In a moment, the spacecraft Cassini, out of fuel, but not out of business, on To the Point from PRI. Warren Alney here with today's talking point. The Cassini spacecraft is one of NASA's greatest achievements, exploration of the planet Saturn, its moons, and its rings. But all good things must come to an end.
After 20 years in space, NASA's Cassini spacecraft is running out of fuel.
But last night, just before midnight at the Jet Propulsion Lab in California, Cassini chalked up another accomplishment. Cassini team members and their family stayed up late and cheered as the spacecraft passed between Saturn and its closest ring. It did that for the first time. Ian O'Neill is an astrophysicist and a science writer at astroengine.com. Good to have you on our show.
Hi there, Warren. Thanks for having me on the show again.
Why is this such a big deal?
Well, we're, as already said, coming to the end of the Cassini mission. So it's basically running out of fuel, and this final voyage is going to take it through a region of space we've never explored before, and that is between the innermost ring and the atmosphere, the upper atmosphere of the planet itself. And there's some mysteries that we're going to discover. This is a new phase of the mission, but unfortunately it's also the end of the mission. So on September 15th, it's actually going to crash into the atmosphere of Saturn to burn up. So, it's a bittersweet ending, really.
Why is it so risky to go between the planet and its rings that it hasn't been done in all the 13 years that Cassini's been up there?
Well, up until now, NASA's been very careful to safeguard the spacecraft, so it's been orbiting well away from any debris in the ring structure. So in the rings, we got very, very small particles, but there's also, they say, particles the size of mountains. So there's some really big things lurking in that ring system. So they've been trying to avoid it up until now. So they've left it until the last possible moments of the mission, or the final months, where they think, okay, we can take the risk now. Let's send it through the rings, and we're going to send it through this apparently empty gap. I mean, there's going to be particles in there, but they're hoping that on each pass through there, it's not going to hit anything sizable, so it's not going to put the mission out of commission. But if worse did happen and it did hit something, it's the end of the mission, all the main science objectives have been completed, and this is just basically a bonus. But regardless, if it hits something or if it doesn't, it's going to burn up on the 15th of September.
So it has cameras, it has observation ability. Can't it just look and see what's in there?
It would not be able to avoid them. It's traveling way too fast. It's on a ballistic trajectory, so basically it's just going to it's flying faster than the fastest bullet we can possibly fire here on Earth. So if it hits something, it's basically curtains for the spacecraft. But that's okay. I mean, it's done incredibly well so far, and as it turns out, it went through the ring system in the early hours of Wednesday morning, and it radioed back, of course, last night, as we heard the cheers from NASA JPL. They actually radioed back, and now there's just a slew of data coming down. It's basically opened up a fire hose of images, very, very close-up images so far of the planet's atmosphere. So these are the closest images we've got so far in the mission of Saturn's upper atmosphere, and it's looking incredible.
When you talk about this trajectory and the fact that it's going faster than a bullet, I think it's like 70,000 miles an hour or something.
Oh, yeah.
Let's just reflect for a moment on what that means. It's been, I think it was 20 years ago it was launched. It got there, it took years to get there, and now it's been there for 13 years, and we're still able to control it and get it to do what you have just described. Isn't that just in and of itself an extraordinary scientific achievement?
It is, and this is one thing we're becoming used to with NASA missions. You know, we've got the rovers on Mars, we've got the Voyager mission that's still transmitting data after decades in space. It's actually interstellar space now. So NASA's very good at building long-duration spacecraft, and spacecraft like Cassini, they're known as flagship missions, so they throw lots and lots of instrumentation onto one mission. They're very expensive. They're as we know now with Cassini, this lasted years beyond its planned lifespan, and it's actually the only reason why they're decommissioning it now, because it's actually running out of fuel. It's actually reached a physical end. And so to avoid contamination to possibly life-giving moons in Saturn orbit, they've decided to incinerate the mission, like the Galileo probe was incinerated in Jupiter's atmosphere when that mission ended. So it's a very fitting end to a glorious mission, and it's going to be sad, but it's just amazing that we've got another 21 of these ring-crossing orbits that we're going to be experiencing almost weekly up until its demise in September.
What's the nature of that fuel it's running out of?
It's basically propellant. So, of course, the mission has to make, when it was orbiting during its prime mission, when it was orbiting Saturn, it had to make small tweaks in its orbit, and so it can orbit very, very close to, say, Enceladus, which is an icy moon, a very small icy moon. And suddenly, when Cassini was in orbit around Saturn, it suddenly became aware that this moon has a habitable potential. It's actually venting water into space. And it contained within this water is organic chemicals, which is extremely exciting because this means the interior of that moon has a heat source. It also has a subsurface ocean of water, and it also has chemicals that are necessary for life. Now, we're not saying there is life there, but there certainly could be. So it used this fuel basically to direct itself through these plumes of water so it can actually analyze the vapor and actually see what's in it. And so that's why this fuel was so valuable. But, of course, now it's running out. So now they're going to do something very very extravagant with the mission. They're going to end it by going through this very mysterious region. And hopefully we're going to make some incredible discoveries along the way, because we've never been to this part of Saturn orbit. We've never been between the rings, and this is a really cool part of the mission.
People like this spacecraft, the Cassini. Google created a Google Doodle about it this week. Why do you suppose it is that people are feeling affectionate toward an object like this?
I think NASA does a very good job at communicating the science, and they do in such a way through social media. And of course, with the advent of Twitter over the years, and you know, Facebook, and all the social media outlets, people get really excited. And I think NASA's policy of opening data to the public as well, it's like you can see the data as it comes down, as the scientists receive it. So it's not like anything's being held back from the public. So there is this connection. And also with Cassini, it's done some amazing things. Recently, it sent back an image of Earth and Moon through the rings of Saturn. So it really puts things in perspective for people. And I think with all the stuff that's going on Earth right at the moment, it's just nice to see a pure science mission, doing incredible things in space, discovering things that we never thought were possible up until this mission actually made it to Saturn, and actually understanding how the solar system evolved. These are really big questions that NASA's trying to answer. And I just think the public engagement is really good, and it's actually become, you know, like the Voyager mission, like the Galileo mission before it, Cassini has become a household name, and I think that NASA should be very proud of that.
The Trump administration has taken a lot of heat for not being interested in science and for denying some forms of science. What's NASA's future?
It's uncertain, and actually NASA, as opposed to like the NOAA, N-O-A-A, Climate Administration. It's hard to tell. I mean, the Earth-based sciences—they're in trouble. I mean, that figures without saying. This dislike for climate science is mind-boggling to me. But it looks like deep space science, things like the Cassini mission—they're not going to be cut anytime soon. And even Trump said when he was put into power that he wants to discover more things about deep space. So I don't think NASA's going to be too badly hit, but I think science in general needs to be concerned, and as the March for Science a couple of weeks ago showed, that there is a global concern that science is being ignored, and I think this is a time to really celebrate science and show what it can do for us, and stop ignoring our planet. You know, climate change is here whether we like it or not, and whether this administration deals with it or the next, we don't know, but the point is we need to sort it out very quickly.
Okay, we have seconds left. After Cassini burns up, what's next? What are we going to see next?
Well, we're going to keep on for the next few months. As I said, we're going to see a lot more images coming back from Saturn. And there's other stuff going on in the solar system right now. Of course, we've got two rovers that are operating on Mars.
Okay.
So we expect to see more stuff coming from the rest of the planets in the solar system.
Ian O'Neill, always good to talk with you.
Thank you so much, Warren.
Astrophysicist, science writer. You can find his work at astroengine.com. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
Public Radio National.